Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the flagship news show of the alternative media that is out there changing history. The turning point of the Syria war was the Al Ghouta false flag, which was exposed in real time. Obama couldn't go along with it. The U.S. didn't go all out after Syria, just like JFK at the Bay of Pigs didn't go all out after Cuba. The result is the Cuban regime still survives today, and so does the Syrian regime. And in the case of Syria, it's all thanks to those of us who expose false flags. So let's get going on a special show with a special guest commentator, Dr. Alan Sabrosky, former head of strategic studies at the U.S. Army War College, and a rather notorious person in some circles for actually speaking his mind about current events in general and 9/11 in particular. So, hey, welcome, Alan. Good to have you.
Thank you, Kevin. I think the notorious part is that one person was arrested for mentioning my name.
Jeremy Rothkuchel.
Yeah, and another person, Bonnie Faulkner, had a show canceled in California for replaying something from the Deep Truth Conference.
Oh my goodness.
We have to be very careful. I mean, this might be the last program that you have here.
Well, I'm going to keep my eye out, looking out the window in case a drone strike is called in. And if it is, I'll just duck, I guess.
I would hope. But it's good to be here, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. I really admire your no-holds-barred approach to calling it the way you see it, and I just wish there were more people like that. I think we could solve problems in the world better if we addressed them more honestly. And speaking of which, Trump, you know, you can say good things about Trump, but being consistently honest is certainly not one of them. And now his surprise rapid U.S. pullout from Syria is maybe happening, maybe not. Alan, what's going on?
Well, it's pretty clear that he realizes politically that he overstepped his bounds, not just with Mattis and some others, but there is virtually no support in the system for him. If there's anything that's been consistent about this, it's that the praise for Mattis for resigning on the fact that Trump announced a pullout was right across the political spectrum. Left, right, Republicans, Democrats, hawks, doves, everything where you put it.
What do you mean doves? There aren't any doves anymore. They're all hawks.
Well, no. There was a dove scene, and it was underneath the latrine in the House of Representatives until Pelosi got there.
Okay.
But also, that's what it was. A lot of praise for Mattis and a lot of opposition to him. And I think it has gradually sunk in that whatever he's going to do, it's going to have to be partial. And it's more extreme in the case of Afghanistan, because all of a sudden we have the ghost of Blackwater rising from the background saying, well, if U.S. troops are leaving, our contractors, e.g. mercenaries, can take their place.
Indeed. Yeah, but I don't know if this is going to really work out so well for the U.S. empire's geostrategic interests. For instance, if Syria is totally sanctioned by the U.S., well, guess who's going to own the new Syria? Iran and Russia and China. Exactly. And likewise, Blackwater, I don't think, is going to deliver Afghanistan into the American camp very effectively.
No, it's not going to be. Absolutely no one from about 2000 BC has delivered that hill country. And that was about 3,000 years before Islam showed up. No one has been able to deliver the tribes in that hill country to anyone. They can take it. That's not a problem. Holding it, that's the problem.
Well, you know, you've had some interesting things to say about civilian control of the military. And we, you came back to VT with a terrific article on that topic, the issue of Mattis, Trump, and, you know, the whole issue of civilian control. And I guess that's linked to the issue of the standard government military versus these private for-profit killing operations like Blackwater. So anyway, here's a little plug for your interview on my radio show talking about that. What's the future for so-called civilian control of the military? And is there really that much of a distinction between civilians and military at the top levels these days?
There is when it comes to dealing with affairs within the services, with the management of the services, and with tactical and operational functions in the field. You know, the Secretary of Defense is in the chain of command for tactical control. He or she can give can give orders to field commanders. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff cannot. It's one of the oddities, or nor can the service chiefs. But and we had a very unusual situation when Trump came into office, and it actually temporarily reassured me. He had a collection of senior generals and senior positions that, you know, very quickly came into power. Mattis was the first of his nominees. McMaster on the National Security Council. Then Kelly came in as chief of staff. Kelly and Mattis were very close and are very close. And so it looked like there was actually going to be the oddity of major national security decisions were going to be, if not made, certainly influenced by a trio of people who knew a great deal about them, which is an oddity for the American system. They're all gone now. And I think the future is going to be business as usual. McMaster's replacement by Bolton was not exactly reassuring. The number of people who are being listed, at least shortlisted from what we can tell publicly, to take Kelly's place as chief of staff, read like a rehash of a combination of neocons and traditional Republicans. There's no indication of who's going to be the permanent replacement for Mattis. It might be his deputy, it might be someone else, but I expect we're going back to business as usual, business by amateurs.
Right. And so getting back to the 9/11 issue, do you see that as being mainly driven by sort of the civilian neocons in the Defense Department, the Israeli lobby and so on, as opposed to people at the top of the U.S. chain of command, and particularly the military, the Joint Chiefs and so on?
Absolutely. No question at all about that. Although, and it doesn't please me to make this next statement, increasingly over the last 15 to 20 years, the senior leadership of the military has itself changed. I mean, there's no question at all about that. The top, you know, all of the top ranks have to be confirmed by the Senate. These people are the people, these people in the sense of those people who are contenders are very realistic, and they're far more politically aware than was the case 30, 40 years ago. And they understand that they have to take certain positions, whether they believe in them or not, and pursue those positions if they're going to be confirmed. I think it is, it's one reason that you find now far more of the senior leadership of all of the services echoing the neocon line, certainly on the Middle East, on Russia, on China, than once would have been the case. And this is not an accident.
And of course, Russia is perturbed by this flock of neocon hawks swooping around its borders with fancy new first strike weapons. And so it's retaliating, as we see in the next slide. Now Putin is deploying the Avant-Garde hypersonic system. It goes Mach 20, which is over 15,000 miles per hour. So if they send one of these at me, I won't even see it coming. But Alan, do you think the neocons' bellicose approach to such issues as the Islamic world and Israel's enemies and Russia and maybe China is all going to backfire at some point?
I don't think so, unfortunately, because no more than when the U.S. and the Soviet Union developed new weapon systems, you know, the original missile gap in the late 50s and early 60s, these things didn't really translate into other areas or affect other areas. This is only in the case if and only if there was a direct confrontation with the very real possibility of U.S.-Russian, in this case, nuclear exchange, would these things matter. What I would be interested in seeing is if this technology, the hypersonic technology, begins to be employed and deployed in the surface-to-surface missile systems, and particularly in anti-ship systems, because this has been one of the things that was discussed, when did I first see it? About a year and a half ago, when there were some rumblings about this type of technology, that the point was made that a hypersonic surface-to-surface missile, surface anti-ship missile, was the one thing that could make the American carrier battle groups highly vulnerable and take them out.
There's a transition matter. towards vulnerability of naval forces, isn't there?
Oh yeah, very much on it. The carriers aren't quite the sitting ducks against these systems that battleships were against carrier air, but it's heading in that direction, and it's the sort of thing that if it can be seen, it can be hit, and if it can be hit, it can be destroyed. And we're rapidly going to that direction, and with the extraordinary increase in accuracy and now in speed of land-based missiles, of land-based and submarine-based missiles.
And of course, this has implications for the sort of larger geopolitical situation, which has been dominated by sea power, as Admiral Mann originally wrote a century almost ago, mm-hmm. and more than that, actually. As opposed to the land-based powers of Russia, China, Iran. First it was the British, then the Americans running the world with their navies. Now the navies are becoming vulnerable. Things may be changing in many ways. The central balance of power may be shifting back to the world supercontinent, Eurasia, as Brzezinski said it was. But this transition has all sorts of possibilities for catastrophe, often through perhaps miscalculation. And here's a piece that quotes Raffaello Pantucci, the director of international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute. So he's kind of in the same business as you, Alan, who is concerned about the possibility of some kind of tragic miscalculation in this standoff between the U.S. and Russian military forces.
Well, I think that if there is a potential for miscalculation, and anytime people get involved in it, there certainly is. It's going to be more on our side than on the Russians. I don't think there's any doubt that they have in part by virtue of being less strong than we are, but the Russians and the Chinese both give every evidence of having a much more realistic assessment of what is taking place and where it's taking place than we do. And a large part of that is the difference in the internal systems that they have in their national security apparatus. I find it very strange, Kevin, and I've mentioned this to you before. I spent virtually all of my adult life planning to oppose the Soviet Union and China, serving in Vietnam with the Marines and then afterwards as a civilian. How do we handle the East-West conflict? I focused on NATO. How do we deal with the Soviets if they came across? And it's sort of odd to me to think that now that America has moved to supplant Britain as the primary global empire. In fact, I would say is the primary evil empire out there. And I'll listen for the black helicopters over my shoulder. If something happens, please keep talking. And that I look on without any illusions about what kind of a systems they have, that I sort of look on the Russians and the Chinese as the factors of stability, with an America as the primary source of instability or destabilization, not so much because of what we are ourselves, but because we are bonded hip and thigh to the Israelis. Mm-hmm. And they are the one who's driving us. Left to ourselves, I don't think there would be that uncertainty and that instability. But they're driving us and they have control. And with their control of the media, the American people will never know it.
Well, they're along with that problem of being driven by these bellicose, kind of like Kudnik Israelis and neocons. We also, of course, are in the Thucydides trap. Historically, whenever there's a rising power that's threatening to unseat the dominant power, the chances of war are about 2 out of 3, according to some analyses. So you add that situation as the U.S. is facing the rise of Eurasian land-based powers, mainly China, of course, with this problem of neocon and Likudnik type influence in the U.S., I think it's a very dangerous situation. I think you're absolutely right.
It is, in fact. And, there was an American political scientist, one of my professors, actually, named Ken Organsky, who had something, the theory of the power transition. He either looked at the major power transitions in the 19th and 20th century, and he said that the greatest point of danger came when the rising power was approaching and almost ready to pass the dominant power.
We're getting there.
Yep. And oddly enough, it was almost an even shake whether it was started by the dominant power to try and keep that challenge from taking place, or by the rising power precipitously to overtake the larger power.
So what did he think about World War One? Who started that? I see it as a preemptive British war primarily. What do you think?
It was very much on it. Although he, like a lot of revisionist historians, today we would call them conspiracy theorists. I wish we would get rid of that phrase. I mean, you and I, at least certainly on that phrase, I don't see it as a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. The people who we are looking at more of a revisionist approach and getting rid of the baggage associated with conspiracy and conspiracy theory would be a good idea. Mm-hmm. But he saw that as something in which the primary contenders were Russia and France for mm-hmm. very different reasons, in opposition to the German and Austro-Hungarian alliance, mm-hmm. and that the British were added to the mix by a very successful and rapidly rising German naval force and mercantile force. Now, if you look at the balance of forces in 1914, it really wasn't even close. You know, everything on the Allied side was far superior in numbers to what the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, and of course later the Turks had. But that didn't matter. That didn't matter. In fact, the German fear of being encircled was very real. It was factually real. Mm-hmm. And my concern is that our proliferation of bases, and we have a very large number of them anyway, our proliferation of bases, which have nothing to do with American national security and everything to do with nailing in place the bastions of an American empire, might have the same effect on Russia or China or both. It's certainly having the effect of drawing the Russians and Chinese closer together, which is not exactly a success from our point of view.
And this all strikes me as totally sensible and accurate, everything you're saying. But as you suggested, such talk might be viewed as conspiracy theories if we took this to the big American think tanks. And in this article, Rafael Pantucci points out that, quote, travel to Beijing, Moscow, or Tehran, and you hear views we would dismiss as conspiracy theories being shared among some of the most sophisticated thinkers as mainstream perspectives. And that's right. I can tell you, I go to Tehran every now and then. I'll be there in February. And everybody there knows, for instance, that 9/11 was a false flag and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think this leads to the observation that maybe the way they've limited discourse in the West and made it so unrealistic is actually contributing to, you know, destabilization, to the weakness of the West. We'll talk more about that in a bit. But in the next slide, we have Soviet military bases in Cuba. Well, they're not Soviet anymore. They're Russian military bases in Cuba. But they're about to reopen, apparently. Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel met with Putin last November and signed $200 million worth of military contracts. It looks like the Kremlin is also deploying strategic aircraft in Venezuela. So are we back in the Cold War again, Alan?
Not at all. I don't know why we should be back in the Cold War any more than our, what is it, we have bases in 108 countries now mm-hmm. out there. Why an American airbase or intelligence station or radar station along the borders of Russia or China is somehow a factor of stability and peace, but them doing the same thing over here is not.
That's a good point. Well, what's good for the goose is supposedly good for the gander, but of course the hegemon doesn't see it that way. I guess arrogance can blind you, you know, to the other guy's point of view. And it is interesting to me that Americans, and even more so Israelis, seem to have this blindness to the other guy's point of view that's, you know, even more than the average human being does. I mean, we human beings are all pretty bad in this respect, you know, tweaking everything to suit our own egos and our own interests. But the Americans and the Israelis really push it to an extreme, in my humble opinion. The Chinese, maybe not so much, but of course, they definitely are pushing their own interests pretty hard. And this week, Taiwan was on the agenda, as this may be a slight exaggeration about World War III tensions soaring.
I would say.
But Xi Jinping has warned Taiwan that China reserves the right to use force to make sure that Taiwan is still part of one China. And I hope I'm pronouncing this properly. Tsai Ing-wen, who's the leader of Taiwan and an independence campaigner, doesn't like that. So there's a debate over Taiwan. I don't think World War III is about to break out, but the U.S. has sent its fleet over into those waters three times in the past year, each time that tension with Taiwan gets stoked up. So, you know, maybe it's slightly destabilizing anyway.
It may be, but I read that. I read as much of the foreign press and foreign media as I can in the native language, if I can do it. You know, French, German, and Spanish language are fine. And others, I'll go to the English language publications, you know, for Israel, China, Russia, and so forth. And I read the English language press, both in China and in Taiwan, formerly the Republic of China. And I don't see anything really different in the Chinese side. There have always been, with regard to Taiwan, two positions from China, from Mao right straight on up to the present. One is that Taiwan is a part of China. It is a province of China, much as Kuwait was formerly the 19th province of Iraq, I understand.
Well, that didn't work out so well for Saddam.
It did not work out for Saddam, but China is, of course, a little bit different. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that there are not two Chinas. That in no way can you speak of two Chinas, and that they have never taken any option off the table to promote a reunification, you know, and that's why the U.S. Seventh Fleet would periodically steam up and down the straits between Taiwan and mainland China, as it was called at the time. That's why we would reaffirm our support for them until we stopped reaffirming their support for them as the legitimate government of China. But the Chinese government in Beijing has never changed those two positions, and it periodically restates them. And the response from Taiwan is varying from acceptance with silence, silently accepting that they remain their own independent, but they intend to continue as an independent state. How long they can do that, I don't know. I think the Chinese understand that an amphibious and airborne assault on Taiwan would be a horribly gruesome affair. Mm-hmm. The Taiwanese defenses are really good. The troops are really good. They are really well armed. And of course, a lot of our computer technology and our memory comes from Taiwan as well as from China. But I don't think anyone reasonably expects that suddenly the rejuvenated Chinese Navy is going to show up on the off the beaches of Taiwan and you're going to see an invasion. So this one in particular strikes me as much more of a bombast on the part of a journalist than it is reflective of any significant change in the relations between China and its temporarily lost province, or between the two Chinas, whichever way you wish to see it.
I actually agree completely with that. Obviously, China, which has had an empire for 3,000 years, is playing the long-term game. They're unlikely to be blitzkrieging Taiwan tomorrow morning, that's for sure.
And not only are they doing that, Kevin, you know, but all the numbers that I've seen seems to reassure me that it'll be a good thing that you and I will be dead before the last part of the century, because the world's going to Asia, and that's where the powers lie: China, India, Japan.
Well, they certainly won't have to worry about American interference, whatever they do with Taiwan 50 years from now. At least it certainly doesn't look that way. And one of the reasons the U.S. empire is sinking down into the waves like Britannia did, it ruled them for a while, but then it sank into them. And we're following the same course, partly, I think, because of really stupid decisions by our policymakers, our elites. And of course, one of the stupidest ever was the decision to murder 3,000 Americans by blowing up the World Trade Center, maybe letting the Israelis blow it up. That ghost of false flags past, that's still haunting us today. Alan, I think part of the reason the U.S. is flailing and sinking is that we've really lost our legitimacy. We've lost our mandate of heaven, as the Chinese put it, mm-hmm. To rule the world based on this descent into lies and cover-ups around the most powerful, impactful event on the human nervous system in all of human history, which was 9/11. That big lie has had really bad impacts on the U.S. as a sustainable long-term project, in my opinion. And so this week we had hackers threatening to dump insurance files related to 9/11. What could be in those insurance files? Well, one of the mysteries of 9/11 is, you know, which big insurers were willing to take this loss when they had to pay out Larry Silverstein, who bought the World Trade Center for $15 million of his own dollars and $100 million of somebody else's on a 100-year lease, and then hit the jackpot just a month later. He bought the Trade Center 1 month before the event, a month and a half, 2 months, whatever it was. And then, boom, double indemnity. First he doubles the insurance, then he collects double indemnity. He walks off with $4.5 billion in cash. Who paid that? And some of the mysteries about the fighting about who was going to take the heat for this obvious false flag may be in those files. On the other hand, it all could be a big distraction from the grand jury investigation into the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center, which is happening in federal court in New York. So what do you think, Alan? Is this real or is this a big distraction?
Distraction. I don't think there's any doubt. I don't think any doubt about it. I would love for it to be real, but I still think it's a distraction. I mean, even if there was a smoking artillery brigade buried somewhere in these insurance files, how likely is it, do you think, that the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal would disseminate them? How likely is it that you think any of the networks would? I don't think it's very likely at all. And you know, the irony of it, I'm not sure if irony is the right word, but it'll do for now. Of this was certainly a game-changing event in terms of the attitude of the American people toward the Middle East and certainly toward Islamic peoples. It was the Pearl Harbor that the PNAC folks wanted to get, and it did that. But the irony of it is that from the perspectives in Europe and Asia, and I read a lot of the German and Japanese press, it was that, you know, why are the Americans so shocked and outraged? They killed 100,000 people, Americans, in one night in a bombing raid on Tokyo. 100,000 people, not 3,000, but 100,000. German and Japanese cities were burned to the ground. You had pictures of wagons and trucks in German cities heaped to overflowing with dead women just from our air raids. And they buckled down and kept fighting. Yeah, they lost. But they didn't go into this, oh my God, how can this happen? This is the most horrible thing in the world. And it basically confirmed the sense that Americans are an incredibly weak and selfish culture.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that's one more aspect of how this event has sapped the legitimacy and the kind of moral base of this country and really, you know, hollowed out our identity. In this particular story, we have the dark overlord as some hacker who's hacked Hitchcock's syndicate and Lloyd's of London. And he said, the dark overlord says, we'll be providing many answers about 9/11 conspiracies through our 18,000 secret document leak. Well, it's one thing if they provide answers, and that's an open question whether that will happen. And if answers indeed are provided, smoking artillery brigades even, we will see whether the mainstream media sees fit to publicize them. That's an issue I discussed with Piers Robinson of the University of Sheffield on our interview the other day. The assumption that we have a free media would suggest that how could you possibly cover up something like 9/11? Well, maybe we need to rethink our assumptions here, folks. Anyway, moving on to more false flags past. How about San Bernardino? We have lawsuits against Google, Facebook, Twitter, all because Islamic State was apparently operating on those platforms, which led to Syed Farouk, 28, and Tafshin Malik, a 100-pound girl of 29, supposedly blowing away a bunch of people at a home for handicapped people in California. And then they were shot down in handcuffs in a grotesquely false official account of, you know, the official account was they went down guns blazing, but the car was found with the windows rolled up, blown out from the outside. So obviously they were just executed and their bodies were in handcuffs. Multiple eyewitnesses confirmed that the shooters were three large white paramilitaries, not a couple with a diminutive little girl. So this story, which I published at Veterans Today, contains some of the information in the book, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino, which we can see in the next slide. So that's the book to go to for the middle range of false flags of 2016, 2017, is that right? 2015, 2016. I can hardly keep track of all these false flags, Alan. it's a yeah, dirty they're, job, they're, but somebody's got to do it.
They're getting pretty interesting. I was actually listening to the BBC World Report. I find, you know, the BBC is not what it used to be, but it's still relatively good when it comes to news in the United States. And it's a lot better than we'll find on ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN, and Fox, and the rest of them. And I have that play in the background. And I was listening to it, and they had, and I think it was patched in from a call to a local station out in San Bernardino. I haven't got, when I've tried to go back to it, I can't find it. But I was listening to it, and they described the, and this woman who was in the building, you know, where the shooting was taking place, you could hear the shots in the background. They had barricaded the door, you know, to try and keep themselves safe. And she described it as three tall white men in black jumpsuits with rifles. Mm-hmm. Okay. And my first thought was, oh God, this is close to Orange County. You know, we've got some renegade John Birchers out there that are really trying to do something nasty. I mean, it was, you know, San Bernardino is, I think it's still a black majority city, with a very strong Latino comment. It's, you know, that type of a Southern California city. And I thought, that was my first thought. Oh my God, the last thing we need is something like this in this country. And it happened. It had not a hint that it could have been a diminutive Muslim couple. And then later the story changed, and I thought, how did three white men in black jumpsuits with rifles morph into a diminutive Islamic couple?
The official story is always, oh, that was just a mistake. Just like when BBC said, well, yeah, we reported that Building 7 came down before it had, but that was just a mistake.
You know, everyone misses 47-story buildings, Stan. You know, that happens. And aside from the fact that, you know, it's, and this carries on not only San Bernardino, but this went down in Orlando. You know, I've been in the Marines, and I know how strong you have to be to carry a weapon and the magazines and the ammunition, and they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. They couldn't do it. This woman was 5 feet tall. She was about, you know, a little over 100 pounds, and she was supposedly in a tactical vest, body armor, carrying Smith and Wesson M&P 223 caliber assault rifle, a magazine with reloading clips, as well as a handgun and a spare pipe bomb and detonator. And while she's doing this, 1 minute after the shooting starts, as she's blazing away with all these weapons, she's tweeting her allegiance to Islamic State.
Again, it's now that's the BBC correspondent. The mistake was made in sending in announcing the collapse of Building 7 while it was still up. I mean, it was going to come down. She just got the timing off.
And there you go.
And this woman in San Bernardino, she had really meant to send the tweet before she started shooting, but since she started shooting, she decided to send the tweet anyway.
Yeah, man. And, you know, those Muslim terrorists are incredibly dangerous, especially at doing things that all they do is ruin the image of Islam in the eyes of the world. And it's interesting, too, that this happened at Inland Regional Center, which is probably the only home for handicapped people in the whole world that was conducting active shooter drills every single month, according to the Los Angeles Times, for a long period before this.
Yeah, I noticed that. I thought that was a nice touch to put on it.
Yeah. It's like Jim Dean at Veterans Today says, you just can't make this stuff up sometimes. But this incessant smear campaign against Islam and Muslims and Arabs, which these false flags are part of course, is a lot of it is coming out of Israel. for Israeli geostrategic purposes. And,
hush your mouth. How dare you say that?
That's true. I should be ashamed of myself. Yeah, obviously, very, very racist. Speaking of racist, Alan, you're half Jewish yourself, right? Yeah. So you must be a self-hating Jew, not an anti-Semite.
That's right. Well, I think that they'd have to see which side. If it's mornings, I'm a self-hating Jew. If it's afternoons, I'm an anti-Semite.
There you go. But you don't hate yourself so much that you don't enjoy a good bagel with lox and cream cheese. That's the important part.
Lox I can't do. Cream cheese, yes.
Really? I'm more Jewish than you. I like lox.
Yeah, I sort of like lox, but I can't do gefilte fish.
Okay. Well, anyway, just because we're both Jewish, Alan, and my mom says I might be like a little teensy weensy bit Jewish from my great-great-great-grandmother or something, doesn't mean that I can't criticize Israel and Zionism. So let's go over to occupied Palestine, where the Israelis vow to make the prison conditions even tougher for Palestinian resistance fighters who, under international law, should be treated as POWs at worst. But they get tortured regularly, and now conditions are going to be made even worse.
You know the out that the Israelis use on this. Under international law, terrorists and guerrillas are excluded from the protections of the Geneva Conventions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a lot of excuses, don't they?
Well, we did it in Vietnam, too, that there were supposed to be different ways of treating the North Vietnamese Army in South Vietnam and of the Viet Cong main force units, which were organized companies and battalions and regiments, actually. But that wasn't supposed to extend down to the odd guerrilla fighting off on his or her own. It's one of those murky things that dealing with insurgencies. And I suppose since the Israelis take are not organized uniform military, they're more likely people scraped out of their homes in the middle of the night than they are anything else, that technically under international law, they would be excluded. But there's always been the presumption that harshness would be limited to the offense. You know, and if someone's offense is throwing a stone or writing a slogan on a wall, it's not the same as throwing a hand grenade into a crowd of people. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis seem to have lost that distinction.
Well, they're notorious for disproportionate conduct in many respects.
In every respect, the American Army, it was a student paper actually at Fort Leavenworth, had an article published, and I believe this was published in the Washington Times on September 10th, 2001, one day before. And it described, you know, what it would be like for the Americans dealing with the Arabs and the Israelis. And I believe the premise, and it's hard to sort out the exact premise. The premise was that American forces would be in Palestine as a peacekeeping force in the event of some sort of a transition to a two-state solution, which, as we both know, is one of those nice little illusions, but nonetheless was there. And their comments were very clear and very blunt. They could not be published today, by the way. They described Mossad as a wild card, cunning and ruthless in print, cunning and ruthless, capable of attacking American forces and making it seem as if Arabs had done it.
Didn't this come out right before 9/11?
One day before. And they described the Israeli army as one which is known for consistent violations of international law. Mm-hmm. And never lets
law interfere. If anything, that's an understatement.
Yeah, and never lets international law interfere with its accomplishment of the mission.
Okay. And they also are pretty hardcore in their propaganda tactics. In the next slide, we have Zionist hackers taking down Richard Silverstein, another self-hating Jew, a self-respecting Jew who's telling a little bit of truth. And Silverstein points out this, you know, taking down his site in a denial of service attack just took it down for a little while, and it ended up publicizing this story that he was talking about, which was about a murder. I think three settlers murdered a Palestinian mother of eight, mm-hmm. and he named the names, which got him hacked and taken down and so on. But all this did was spread the story and make it go viral. So these information warriors out of Tel Aviv are not always as smart as people might think.
That's true. And, much the same thing happened, I guess, was it 3 years ago when that Palestinian family of four was burned to death by settlers? Mm-hmm. I think about 2.5-3 years ago. Husband, wife, two tiny children. I think the youngest was 18 months old. Settlers were taken in, held, and I believe that they have been released without any penalties. But several sites tried to announce, tried to describe what had happened. They too were taken down, but the resulting recovery of these sites also served to disseminate it, except in the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, don't look to the mainstream media for anything that's, real. Well, crimes of Zion is one category, and a closely related category, of course, is the crimes of Ibn Saud. The latest story from the front page of the New York Times about that is about the Saudis hiring these Janjaweed Sudanese child soldiers, many of whom are implicated in horrific atrocities, rapes and so on, taking them from Darfur, Sudan, over to Yemen to murder Yemeni children on behalf of the Saudis. And Yemen has become such a horrific site of suffering. Meanwhile, you're not supposed to criticize this lunatic, Bin Salman, the guy who steps in it everywhere he turns. Netflix can't even broadcast a comedy show with very mild criticisms of Bin Salman, or BS, as we call him. compared to the stuff I say about BS, this guy, Hassan Minhaj, is really tame. But the Saudis don't want their people to even see that, just like they couldn't handle the really tame and lame critiques of Khashoggi. This guy, Bin Salman, must have the world's thinnest skin.
He must on that side of that. I'm not sure he's insane. I think he's just ruthless, unless you consider ruthlessness to be a form of insanity.
He's supposedly addicted to designer amphetamines. That's the rumor I've heard.
Oh, really? Yeah. I did not know that. That's interesting.
He kind of acts like it. Amphetamines can lead people into paranoia and lashing out violently, and he seems to do that.
Do you think he uses the same pharmacist as Trump?
Well, he's I don't know. He's lost weight more effectively than Trump has, if that's
the
goal.
Yeah. Trump can definitely find the food bowl. The sort of irony on it, an odd parallel occurred to me. Back when Lyndon Johnson came out with the so-called war on poverty, which has, of course, worked so remarkably well within the United States. It's not quite like adding ice to the Titanic to keep the cocktail lounge going, but pretty close to it. There was a joke in those days that Lyndon Johnson created the war on poverty to make the war in Vietnam look good. Mm-hmm. And my suspicion is that the Israelis have decided to bond themselves to the Saudis, because compared to what the Saudis do, they don't look so bad sometimes,
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, Alan, when I talk about these insane crimes of the Saudis, pretty much in the same breath with my discussions of the insane crimes of the Israelis, I get smeared ruthlessly and relentlessly everywhere as an evil anti-Semite for talking about Israel, but I never get smeared as an Islamophobe for talking about Saudi Arabia. I don't know how that works.
I don't either. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Terribly, terribly ashamed. Well, hey, let's come back to the land of the free, right? The Middle East, we know that's a mess. So let's come back to the land of the free, where disabled veterans are being ripped from their wheelchairs and beat up and pepper sprayed for questioning ID policy at Walmart.
You meant the United States.
Like this every day.
You meant the United States. I didn't realize that's what you were referring to.
Well, if he's trying to buy champagne at Walmart in Riyadh, then of course they should pull him out of his wheelchair and beat the crap out of him. That's haram. Champagne is totally haram. But here in the United States, the land of the free and the home of the secularist brave, I thought you were allowed to buy champagne on Walmart on New Year's Eve, but I guess not.
Well, I'm surprised at this, because most of the time that these things come up, and these things will occur periodically, not just with Walmart, but with other stores and things like this, as the story develops, you find out that it's not quite a children of darkness inflicting harm on a child of light, that the child of light was less than nice himself or herself. And so I'd like to see a little bit more on this before
The video is pretty bad. Did you look at the video?
I saw the video. The video itself is not a joy. What it doesn't tell me is what I'm hearing. I couldn't hear anything. Now there may be audio there, and what they're saying, what the Walmart people are saying, and a couple of my friends actually work in Walmarts in different places, is that, you know, if they run into an enormous amount of verbal crap and harassment from a lot of customers, not just other things, but it happens. And that their story is that there was a fair amount of verbal abuse from the guy directed at some of their employees, and that they called the police to deal with that. Even having said that, there's got to be better ways of dealing with it, with a guy in a wheelchair, you know, than to have half a dozen people descend on him, you know, unless it was a very slow day for the police and they had nothing better to do and they decided to give everyone a chance to get involved. I mean, at best, you know, as I said, I'm not prepared to say it's a totally innocent guy being abused by totally maniacal police officers and a thoughtless Walmart, although any of those things can be possible. But even so, at a minimum, you've got a disproportionate use of force.
Well, you know, Alan, I used to have a friend in San Francisco whose brother worked on the force, and he had a T-shirt that he wore off duty that had the legend on it, "Police brutality, the fun part of the job."
Yes.
I mean, I suppose that's kind of funny, but it's also not so funny if you're on the receiving end of this kind of stuff. And the thing is that we do have a problem in this country. Most countries in the world, at least most of the relatively civilized and developed ones, don't have cops that go off on people so quickly. Those cops will take hours to talk somebody down rather than just wrestle them to the ground and all jump on them and start pummeling them, which is what U.S. cops all just seem to do. Maybe partly because they're trained in Israel. I don't know. Maybe in Israel they train on you know, fake Palestinians in wheelchairs, and these guys just triggered back to their training from Tel Aviv. Speaking of the land of the free, how about the free speech issue over at Patreon? I'm on Patreon, Alan. I get a significant chunk of what passes for my income over on Patreon. And now the biggest guys on Patreon, people like Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin, are leaving Patreon to protest the censorship from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And don't worry, we're going to go back to the previous story after we do this one. But in any case, the deal here is that they threw off some guy named Sargon of Akkad or something like, or Akkad of Sargon. Sargon of Akkad of Akkad of Sargon, or whatever he is, some guy who used a couple of naughty words like the N-word in seemingly ironically in a YouTube video totally separate from Patreon that was never posted there. And because he'd said a couple of naughty words on a YouTube video, they threw him off. And so that does seem a little excessive to me, and it raises this issue of deplatforming people who are putting out non-mainstream views.
I wonder if they would apply the same thing to Hollywood celebrities who give the president a double middle finger and an obscenity after that. It would be interesting if they deplatformed them and saw what happened to it. That would be a little bit interesting. I have never been happy with that. I've had my multiple and pleasant times in Facebook jail for the oddest of things on it. I think the first one was when I put a cover, Time magazine cover, that had in 1938 that had a picture of Adolf Hitler. And you know, Time magazine's Man of the Year, 1938. This was apparently a violation of community standards.
Well, they should sue Time magazine then.
Exactly. You know, I suggested that to Facebook, but they didn't really seem to appreciate that. I don't like the idea of any type, not only of any type of censorship on social media, but particularly taking something one says or does in one place and using it to justify, that's with quotation marks, by the way, to justify how one treats that same person on another medium. I mean, it's, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, there was no justification that I can see for that. On the other hand, we have to realize, as you certainly do, Kevin, that there's a sort of overlapping directorship among a lot of these groups like Facebook, YouTube, and Google. And guess what? We look at them, we'll see many of the same people or same types of people on all sides of them. And the SPLC and ADL, who don't exactly like me very much, I can't imagine why, do that play in all of these venues. They play in all of them. And that has a very distinct effect on it. I hope you stay on it.
I'm going to stay on it. I'm staying on it partly because counterbalancing this horrible censorship is the fact that Patreon will actually talk to you if they have a problem with what you're doing and give you a chance to negotiate a solution. A real human being apparently contacts you, and that is actually pretty rare for these big media, online media type outlets. And so I'm going to hang in there with Patreon for now and hope that they adjust their policies a little bit. But we'll see where it all goes. Anyway, let's go back to the previous story, which is actually one of the most important ones, potentially another Land of the Free story. Journalists do sometimes just keel over dead rather abruptly when they're doing dubious things. And here we have Bree Payton, who broke the story of Robert Mueller's team deleting text messages, just died very suddenly at a very early age. She's still in her 20s, or she was. Yeah. What do you think, Alan? This looks just, it stinks to high heaven as far as I can tell.
I would agree with that. And she had done a show the night before, hosted a show, and 24 hours later, she's dead. And that's to put it mildly, that's more than a little suspicious. Mm-hmm. There was a guy I knew, he was 54, 55, Vic Thorne. Wrote for American Free Press and a number of others. He coined the phrase the Clinton body count, had a book by that title on it. Mm-hmm. He had interviewed me a few times, and I had talked to him about 3 months before his supposed suicide on his birthday, deciding to shoot himself in the head, as the story went. You know, he had a couple of new book contracts. He was very enthusiastic. And, you know, sure, you can never really get inside another person's head. We both know that. And, you know, you never really know what else could be happening in a person's life, you know, in a period of 3 months. But he would not be on the top 10,000 list of likely suicides to me. He really wouldn't. And it's, you know, I used to, when I was young and slightly more foolish than I am now, only slightly, disbelieve in these sorts of things. But increasingly, it becomes obvious that an awful lot of people die under awfully suspicious circumstances when they finger a relatively small number of people in very prominent positions. And certainly Robert Mueller would be in one of those positions. And do so when there is no obvious reason for their death. And the difficulty is considering how compromised the FBI is, and it's unfortunately it's no less compromised now than it was 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, Mueller was part of that Boston scandal where FBI people were helping the mob murder folks. So
yeah. The thing that's strange on it, not strange in the sense of dubious, but strange is that normally it was the CIA that indulged in those kind of wet operations internally. Mm-hmm. Through his counterintelligence office, and the FBI was relatively good for a long time.
The FBI had some pistol envy for the CIA.
Well, considering the predispositions of J. Edgar Hoover socially, that might very well have been the case.
Okay, you know, Alan, we only have about six minutes technically left. We can go a little bit over, but we're going to have to probably pick up the pace a little bit because I know you really wanted to talk about this next story, which actually is two slides down the list. The Dr. Lara Kolab, 27-year-old doctor, another young female who's maybe being mistreated, was fired from her position as an internal medicine resident at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. Her career was destroyed by Canary Mission, which mm-hmm. is a sort of Israeli intelligence outfit designed to make everybody miserable who is telling the truth about occupied Palestine. So here she seems like maybe she went a little too far with a couple of her tweets joking about giving Jews the wrong meds. That's definitely tasteless. But these pro-Palestine tweets of hers are totally reasonable.
Well, they are. And again, you know, if you have a doctor, any kind of a doctor, who says that I'll give X and you can fill it in, the wrong meds, that's not something you can joke about. If I mean, if you or I said it,
it's beyond tasteless.
yeah, I mean, if you or I said that, you know, we don't prescribe medications, we don't write prescriptions, we're not going to be doing this. You know, it with us, it'd be the same thing as saying, I'm going to make you eat haggis. And if you've ever had haggis, you understand that that might not be a war crime, but it's certainly a dietary
Well,
offense.
maybe not, but lutefisk, forcing you to eat lutefisk with the Norwegians,
Oh
that would
God.
be a war crime.
Now that would definitely be a war crime. But I had never heard of Canary Mission before, so I clicked on the link and went to its website. And it presents itself initially as we're here to root out anti-Semitism and hatred. Well, unfortunately, when you get into what it describes on its website, it includes criticism of Israel, participation in BDS, anything like this that have nothing to do with anti-Semitism, except in the sense that the new anti-Semitism is described as just that. Any type of criticism of Israel or Israeli policy or the Israeli government, this constitutes a form of anti-Semitism or any action that can be detrimental to Israeli interests. This is anti-Semitism. So if we have Israeli army snipers shooting and killing a 6-year-old boy in the head and killing him, or shooting a 21-year-old Palestinian nurse in the back and killing her, to mention that in anything except a laudatory tone would be anti-Semitism to Canary Mission. And this just piles on top of a lot of groups. I'm sure you're familiar with them. Jihad Watch, Campus Watch, all of that part of Hasbro collectivity
The
out there.
Zionist Thought Police.
You got it. You got it with no doubt what's, and they are the ones that have not only taken over the Jewish political movement in the United States, they are the ones that dominate most of the conservative groups. Oh, you might be amused by this, or not amused in a humorous sense. One of the groups that they also list on their hate groups, they have a long list of individuals and a long list of groups, is the Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP.
Oh yeah,
That's
what a
it.
terrible hate group.
I obviously, you know, I'm not sure they probably all sit up there and eat roast pork and shrimp every day or something like that on it.
JVP, definitely in bed with Hamas and threat to civilization. Speaking of threats to civilization, we're gonna have to go through these stories real fast here. We have a piece about no, we've already done this one. Yeah, why conspiracy theories matter. This is from Vox.com. Conspiracy theories can diminish faith in institutions and government. Oh boy, that's terrible, isn't it? We should
Yep.
have a lot of faith and trust in our institutions of government that stage all these false flags and assassinations and so on and so forth. And well, next slide. I just interviewed a guy named Keith Con Harris. He's a kind of a moderate liberal Zionist, Jewish guy, a professor of sociology, I think, from London. And he just wrote this book, Denial, saying that pretty much all believers in conspiracy theories are secretly wishing for horrible things. Like Holocaust deniers basically are just trying to hide the fact that they want to kill all the Jews. Global warming deniers basically want the whole world to die horribly because and they want to keep on using fossil fuel to make that happen, et cetera, et cetera. So this was an interesting conversation. He's not quite as completely insane as his ideas might sound. So people can listen to that.
Are you sure?
Well, you listen to
I
the interview,
actually
make
read
up your
that.
own mind.
Yeah,
Make up.
I read that and I thought the fellow could use some help. You know, really got
Well, that was kind of my first response. Like I've kind of mind boggled, between the insanity on the one hand of the basic thesis, and many of its component parts, and kind of certain kinds of thoughtful ruminations on larger, vague talk. I think he's good with large, vague, broad ruminations on deep emotional, metaphysical, psychological type things, but not so sharp maybe on kind of the, you know, cut to the chase, empirical, logical type thinking. But anyway, speaking of conspiracy theories, any professors who ever endorse any conspiracy theories are being treated horribly. Pierce Robinson is the latest. Professor Anthony Hall, our colleague at False Flag Weekly News, of course, was witch hunted for a year and a half over this. So I just talked with Pierce Robinson, who is getting a lot of flack from his perch at the University of Sheffield, where he's the chair at Politics, Society, and Political Journalism. He's lecturer to NATO's Defense College in Rome, to senior UK military commanders at Oxford, a very illustrious top-rate academician. But here we have the Huffington Post saying he's a 9/11 truther, and he comes on my radio show. Wow, well, that convicts him, I suppose, of something.
Yeah, it should be on that. You should actually put up against that every time someone comes up on it, that little clip in Danish, but with English subtitles, by Niels Herit from, from Denmark, who had on one of his morning shows the comment that there's, in response to a question about a conspiracy theory from the host, there is only one conspiracy theory out there, and that is the story the U.S. government puts out.
Pretty much. Well, and then there's Joshua Goldberg. Joshua Goldberg created this horrific kill all Jews immediately image that got planted on Tony Hall's Facebook page and triggered the scandal that led him to being witch hunted horrifically from the University of Lethbridge, where he's now retired with full professor emeritus status and full pension. So he kind of won that battle, or at least fought him to a draw. Joshua Goldberg is this crazy troll who is trolling all over the internet, got convicted of terrorism, serving 10 years in prison for trying to help build ISIS bombs. Anyway, here he is explaining how things look from his side of things. So I just urge people to read that and scratch your heads over the enigma of Joshua Goldberg. Moving on to Brazil, we have Jair Bolsonaro, the Brazilian Trump, only probably a lot worse, collapsing democracy down there. Moving to India, we have 3 million females of all ages and all walks of life and all colors. In a beautiful 620-kilometer human chain image protesting the closing of a Hindu shrine, Sabarimala Shrine in Kerala. You know, women are welcomed in all mosques. They have to be. Maybe they have to go to the upstairs section or the back, but at least they're welcome to mosques, whereas the Hindus are actually much harder on women than Muslims. Hindus for ages were forcing widows to burn themselves to death, burn themselves alive after their husband died, things like that. So just something to keep in mind. And finally, moving on to China and then the moon, not just the moon, but the dark side of the moon. I'm getting flashbacks of a Pink Floyd song here. Right on, Roger Waters. Yeah, I love Roger Waters. Anyway, the Chinese are there. They got there first. They beat us to the dark side of the moon, Alan. This is the end of American hegemony. Right?
Well, what did they find there?
They're not telling.
They're going to have the first Chinese restaurant on the moon. Now, that is the true conspiracy. There are Chinese restaurants at almost every corner gas station in America, every crossroads, and probably in the world. And at the right moment, the proper amount of monosodium glutamate will take effect and will all drop. And the Chinese will rule the world.
So if we finally do get a manned mission to the moon and we go, or the Russians do, and they go and check on the supposed Apollo landing sites, which the head of the Russian space program says he's going to do, and then he winks, maybe there'll be a Chinese restaurant right next door to the American Apollo 11 landing site.
Exactly. Offering very interesting fortune cookies.
All right. Well, hey, thank you, Alan Zabrowski. It's been an interesting set of fortune cookies on False Flag Weekly News today. I really appreciate your excellent work, and I look forward to maybe doing this show and certainly doing some more radio shows with you down the line. And keep on posting at Veterans Today. Your work is too good to be, you know, lurking and out of our sight for so long.
Kevin, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners and supporters. God bless. See you all, God willing, next week.